It is often said that the defining attribute of humans is their language ability. But how much do we really know about animal communication? And how, indeed, can we define what language is? To find out what is known scientifically about these questions, I contacted Sarah Waller, professor of philosophy at Montana State University, who has studied this field for years. She graciously agreed to the interview you are about to hear. I learned how she became interested in animal language, how she funds and carries out her research activity, and what she has learned in working with a variety of animal species. Her perspective as a philosopher allows her to integrate the different disciplines involved in such work, including biology, mathematics, linguistics, and psychology. Our discussion took place in two parts during September 2016.
Describe what it is that you study and how you came to do that.
Okay, well, I'm currently a philosopher at Montana State, and I got my PhD in philosophy of language. I worked on a dissertation trying to answer the question of how language gets its meaning. So how is it the case that we can talk to each other and understand words? It's a great mystery. There are six leading theories, and we have no idea, really, how to decide between these theories. All of them have flaws, all of them have strengths, but we don't know how language works. So I finished this dissertation, and I think, really, I probably just wanted to go outside. I had been inside, buried in books for a very long time. And I found a dolphin internship at San Diego State University. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's neat. I'm going to go out on the water, and I'm going to go on a boat and see some dolphins, and that'll be great, because, of course, it's hopeless, and philosophers never get jobs, and I just thought I was doomed. So it turns out we go out on the boat the first day, and we drop a hydrophone in the water, and I hear what sounds like language that I don't know how to translate, that no one knows how to translate, which is a classic problem in philosophy of language and was a centerpiece of my dissertation. How do you know when you've translated from one language into another language and done so accurately? So, wow, there we were, and it sounded like the dolphins were talking, and here is our problem of radical translation, and I realized that I hadn't left philosophy at all, and I hadn't left my dissertation behind at all, and here I was saying, wow, here's the real problem. It's not about human languages, it's how we communicate with animals and how they communicate with us, or how we fail to do that.
Hmm. There are a whole bunch of things you said there that I want to dig into a little bit. One is, first of all, just what is language to you? I mean, you were talking about words and so on and sounds. Is a street sign language? Can language be visual? What other forms?
So there's a classic distinction between language and communication that most people accept, though it is slippery and people fight about it. So communication is merely the transfer of information. So what that means is that if I farted, I hope I can say that on the radio.
I think that's what I'm
going to. If I farted, I communicate things to you about my digestive process, pleasant or otherwise, right? But it doesn't involve my intention, right? It's a physiological process that kind of happens without any sort of cognition. Now, you as the receiver of the information, you still gain information, so communication has taken place. But language needs to leap the bar much higher than that. So this is beyond belching and farting or accidentally signaling, you know, sweatiness or breathing on one another and all of those things that social animals do. So language has to be about the abstract, the past, the future, things that we can't point to, time and zero and plans 2 years in the future, or abstract concepts like equality, justice, and love. Once you start playing around in that, you're starting to enter the realm of language. And then the other classic part of that definition is language has what's called infinite iterativity. And that's a very fancy word, but what that means is that I can make run-on sentences forever and ever and ever and ever. And just when you think that I'm going to stop that sentence, I can always add another meaningful clause to it. So there's a structure of language that lets us nest meanings within meanings within meanings and lets us go on and on and on. whereas communication is thought to be much more primitive signaling. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I'm cold, I'm looking for a mate, etc., etc. Concrete, limited, specific signals that do not generate into an infinite vocabulary and an infinite number of ways of expressing ourselves.
So you said when you heard those dolphins on the hydrophones, you felt like that was language, not just communication, I guess. And so what was it about that? Or how were you just being hopeful that this went beyond those basic forms of communication? Well, or
So the experience in the boat, I just thought, wow, I'm still doing the same thing. But then as I read up on it, I learned that that initial instinct, that initial moment of excitement was absolutely right. That we've decoded a little bit of what dolphins say to each other. We know what a signature whistle is. So each dolphin has a specific, unique signature whistle that is, it functions something like a neighing. It identifies one individual rather than another. They say it themselves and they use it to call one another. So it's very clear that there's something like a Bill and a Bob and a Nancy and a Sue. But then there are these other parts of dolphin whistle sequences that do not seem to be so patterned, do not seem to be so repetitive, seem to be complex. And why are they making these sounds? Unless they have some sort of meaning, unless they have a signaling property. That's what a complex language is. It's something that's got a little bit of pattern and a little bit of randomness and a lot of complexity so that we can convey all sorts of interesting thoughts to one another.
Mm-hmm. Are you still working with dolphins at all? Or I know you've ended up working with a number of different species. How have they been chosen, or is it kind of who you happen to be collaborating with at the moment and what they're working on, or... why did you end up working?
There are lots of different reasons for everything. When I started working with dolphins, I was on the California coast, and so it was easy and accessible. I still do it every spring, and that's been wonderful. I got a fantastic grant when I was at Cal State Dominguez Hills that allowed me to buy a boat and a hydrophone and all the equipment that we need to take students out on the boat and do research. So every spring break, I go down with a group of students, and it's combined a group of Montana State students and some California State students, and we go out on the boat together, and we take a sample every year. Just sort of as a tangent, that sample has been a little troubling because 10 years ago, we used to see Tursiops dolphins, which are the dolphins that we're all familiar with. That's the species Flipper, king of the sea. So those friendly, big-brained dolphins that we all know, they would frequent L.A. Harbor. And so we would find ourselves very easily very close to pods of those, and we could watch them behave, and we could record their whistles. In the past 10 years, the waters have gotten warmer. L.A. Harbor has gotten much more noisy and probably much more polluted in certain ways. Certainly lots more human traffic, little boats, ski jets, and so on. And the tursiops are gone. We saw two this year. We saw two this last spring. And they've been replaced by Pacific whitesides. Now, Pacific whitesides are the ones that look like orcas, so they're very pretty. They've got kind of the black jacket and then the tuxedo front, so they're gorgeous. And they're very sociable, they're very friendly, and they swim in bigger pods. So you get tursiops there in pods of 12, so that's wonderful and fun for taking data because you get to see what each individual is doing and how they're interacting. Pacific whitesides, you got pods of 35 or 45 dolphins, and they're doing so many things. It's like, you know, I'll have one student on the camera, and I'll have one student on the hydrophone, and one student's driving the boat, one student's doing the spotting with the binoculars to try to see where everybody is. The camera person almost went crazy 2 years ago because there were so many on either side of us, and they were doing all this fabulous camera moves. You know, they were leaping up over the boat and winking at us on the way by, and just this wonderful stuff. We couldn't film enough. And they love people and they love to come by the boat, and they're not endangered, so we don't have to be careful, we can drive through them, and they like it when we drive through them. So we got some fantastic data and some fantastic footage. But I think the most troubling footage is that the species population has completely changed in LA Harbor, and now it's all Pacific whitesides.
Hmm. And do you notice a difference in language behavior or
so,
vocalizations?
The Pacific whitesides, it's a little shorter and a little choppier, but once again, this is something that is really hard to figure out. So we see little differences in the dialects, but I can't, unfortunately, give you the code and say this is how you speak dolphin and this is how you respond to the different dialects. So still in the works. If anybody'd like to come and help me process the data, please contact me.
So how about some of the other species you've worked with? Do you have any favorites?
Right. So what happened? Oh, what happened is I took a job in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve, and suddenly I was far away from the dolphins. And so I started looking at coyotes. Mm-hmm. And I started looking at coyotes because when I was working with the dolphins, kind of the joke among the dolphin researchers is that, you know, they're the wolves of the sea. Because they're social, they're cooperative, they hang around in packs, they raise their young and share babysitting duties and all of these things that wolves do. So if you're just going to go down a checklist of behaviors, dolphins and wolves and coyotes behave very similarly. So then you say, oh, wow, so now I'm in Cleveland, let's do some coyotes. Fascinating stuff. There are coyotes taking over most of our urban areas in the United States and Canada. There are coyotes all over Halifax. There are coyotes all over Chicago and coyotes all over Cleveland. And weirdly, they love airports.
Hmm. Why do you think that is?
They, I think it looks to them like, you know, you've got a lot of tarmac. Mm. And so, you know, if you're looking for a place to live and what you do is dig in order to make a place to live, you look for something that has some nice solid roofing. And so you go, oh, wow, that's a great roof. Let's just dig under there and have some kids. So they're often found at airports, which is a problem because, of course, if they dig too far under the tarmac, the planes cannot land. So there's a little bit of a battle going on between coyotes and what habitats they prefer and human beings and, oh, I don't know, wanting to land our planes or drive trucks on roadways and things like that. So we've got some concerns conservationally about how we're going to live and they're going to live in the same place.
I can imagine that also, you know, having a very flat environment where ground squirrels could probably be seen at a great distance.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
It's very convenient for the coyotes to be living there.
I think you're really onto something there. Mm-hmm. Nice hunting grounds and bunnies and so on and so forth. But let me just finish answering your question. So then I came to Montana and I continued to do the coyote work, which was fantastic because I now have coyote recordings from Cleveland and Chicago, North Dakota, Montana, and Malibu, California. So I have all these recordings from all over the country and they do sound different all over the place. But being in Montana, I met my research partner, Eric Kirschenbaum. He's at Cambridge, but he's been very interested in wolves. And so I'm close to Yellowstone and he's interested in wolves. And so we got together talking about canids and, you know, doggy cooperation and coyote cooperation and wolfy cooperation. And so he was excited to record the wolves. So then we started recording wolves along with coyotes in Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm. How far have you come in trying to decode the language, I guess, and to what extent does, you know, wolf language or dolphin language begin to resemble human language that we're familiar with? Or
I wish I could tell you everything, but the dictionary still awaits us. What we have are 2 years of data that tell us a lot of things. They tell us where the wolves move. They tell us that we can identify individual wolves and where they're moving. So we know that there's something about that vocal signaling that is sort of like a name or a signature howl. We know who's who, and we know what pack is what pack. That's the same with dolphins also, is we can identify all that. We're working on doing some contextually based decoding. So do they sound different when they have killed an elk or when they are meeting on a rendezvous site that is an area where humans have been or an area where humans are not allowed to be in the park, do they sound different when they are taking care of puppies? Do they sound different when they're not on the hunt, but really just meandering, checking out new territories and so forth? So these are questions that we've finally gotten the capacity to be able to start to ask and answer, because I finally have enough students who are working on hours and hours worth of data, hours and hours of wolf howls across 2 years of seasons in Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. So I hope I'll have the answer for you in a year or two.
Do you have any indication yet of whether some of the communication is at a more abstract level than the very concrete things of me and you and an elk and over there, that sort of thing?
So we're working on trying to model what sounds wolves make and what formations they make when they are cooperatively hunting. So, right, one of the famous sort of legends that turns out to be true about lions is that lions will actually sit together and look at each other before they go on a hunt. But so far as we know, they don't make any sounds at all. They just sort of sit in almost like a football huddle or something, but there is no verbal communication. And then they go hunt, and everyone seems to know their position and who's going to move where and who's going to make the first move and who's going to circle around the back and so on and so forth. So that's been kind of a mystery. Wolves are very vocal. Wolves are always yipping and yapping. There's signaling going on when the packs get together all the time. And then you do see these graceful patterns of wolves pursuing different prey, constantly looking at each other and signaling to each other, and then recognizing, oh, you're chasing someone that's really fast, whereas I'm onto something, so why don't you come and join me? So it seems to be sort of a combination of being aware of your surroundings and kind of paying attention to where the ball is, but also some verbal signaling going on, some camaraderie, some visual signaling going on, telling some to come here or some to stay back and so on, some members of the group.
Mm. So you mentioned that these are very social animals, mm-hmm. and does it require social interaction to develop language over time evolutionarily, or for an individual to learn language? I guess there obviously must be interaction
deep
with at
into
least,
the theory,
you know, parents or something, but.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Wittgenstein makes a famous argument that you cannot have a private language. And the reason for that is simply that if you were to say, I shall strike out later today and develop a language that only I understand, and what I will do is I'll just take notes to myself in a secret notebook, and that secret notebook will just be my secret language. The problem with that is that when I go back to that notebook tomorrow, what if I don't remember what all of my new secret notations mean? Or maybe I think I remember, but in fact I don't remember. Right? So what keeps me honest? What keeps me certain that I know what I meant yesterday or 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago or 10 years ago? I often don't remember what I was thinking 10 years ago. This is why we take notes, but this is also why we talk to each other. Right? Our friends remind us what we were thinking 10 years ago. Our friends remind us what we were thinking yesterday, right? When we were upset, because you kind of go on and your consciousness drifts in one way or another. So it seems like developing an individual symbol system completely fails, and that we need to keep checking with each other about the meanings of the words. And we have all sorts of social signals for this. So I say, so do you get what I mean? And you'll either nod at me or you'll say, I'm confused. I didn't understand that. So you'll give me a signal that makes me go back and explain it more, or a check mark saying you've understood.
How well do you think we actually do understand each other? Or how do we know that we've understood each other? I guess somehow what we say must correlate with actions or other observations, and we think, oh yeah, I was right about what she was thinking or planning to do.
I think it's incredibly slippery, which is probably why I'm a philosopher and not a linguist or a psychologist, because there's always going to be a gap. It's one human mind and another human mind, and no matter how similar we are, we conceive of the world a little bit differently. Now, of course, these social checks work because we develop agreements that work. So I want to buy a can of Coke or Pepsi, and I give you some money, and you give me the soda, and we're off to the races. And I know that my communication has worked, your communication has worked, and everybody goes home happy. So when it's simple and concrete like that, we're great. And this kind of goes back to your question about the wolves hunting. It's like, you know, when you've got the elk, you know that whatever that signal system was, it worked perfectly. But boy, when we're talking about notions like equality and justice and fairness and divinity or consciousness, that it's pretty slippery just between human individuals. And so researching that in terms of what wolfy consciousness might think about the divine or life after death or justice, that's going to be hard to do, and you're going to have to be a very clever observer and experimental designer in order to pull out that sort of meaning.
One thing humans do with language is we have humor, and you could have a sight gag, but it seems like it's relatively rare, and most of our humor seems to be language-based. That's what occurs to me. I don't know if you think that's true, and do you think that any of the animals have displayed humor? Do they tell jokes on each other? Or
what a great question. So Merlin Donald, who is a wonderful cognitive scientist, has put forth a theory not so long ago in a book called A Mind So Rare, in which he says this is actually the dividing line between humans and other beings. Humor, sarcasm, wit, verbal jokes. That's, you know, we've proposed all of these dividing lines over the years, right? Tool use or language or empathy or cooperation or, you know, you name it. We've proposed it as a dividing line. So, Dr. Donald says it's humor. And of course, there are some stunts that really seem to be human only. When I watch Stephen Colbert, my cats do not watch him with me. Not in the same way where I'm giggling at this or that political joke. And yet, some of the things that I've seen in the animal world make me think that they absolutely do have a sense of humor. I just got chickens this summer as part of my Montana adventure, and everyone's been teasing me that I need to have a chicken vocalization project as well as all these predatory vocalization projects. And the chickens, you know, they've got a nice big coop and a nice big run, but I do keep them in a large kind of luxury cage because I worry about predators at night. And the magpies come out in the morning and they line up in front of the cage. And it just looks like they are teasing them, throwing little sticks into the cage and then flapping away, flapping back. And it seems like a form of humor. I'm not sure if the chickens get it, but the magpies really do seem to be cooperating and doing something coordinated and sophisticated, and they seem to find it entertaining. Now they don't laugh the way we do, but there's something going on where that's enjoyable to kind of come in and tease the chickens a little bit.
Are there... how about cross-species communication? Do some animals either speak to each other or with humans? Of course, we love to talk to our pets, and we imagine that they're probably understanding us perfectly.
Did you see the new Dog Cog article that just came out?
I did,
two days ago.
New York
Times.
So it seemed pretty vague and almost what you could predict without having done any experiment, essentially I think that...
those are the kinds that you get funded for.
Right, well, so I think the gist of it was that they understand something about what we're saying, like whether it's, you know, sit or come here, but also our tone of voice, yeah, how we say it, is important. And they both have to fit for the communication, right, to work well.
So if you say, I love you, you ugly doggy, they seem to pick up on that there's a negative word in there, even if you're saying it in your most coochie-coo voice. So mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting that it's both the prosodic or the intonational parts, as well as really recognizing the words themselves. And, you know, this research gets so widely publicized because we still think so poorly of animals, you know, in general. We think, oh, well, they don't really understand any of the words that we're saying. And so you get this wonderful indication that they actually do, right? They know what these words mean. Certainly my cats behave differently. I've tried this experiment on my own, so to say, where I say, oh, Nikki, you're a fat kitty, but you're so adorable. And he doesn't react the same way as when I'm just adoring all over him and loving him. He's not quite so eager to approach. Interesting stuff. I'm trying to think of other cases of humor across species or among animals. And I'm thinking mostly of zoo animals, right, where you do get chimpanzees ganging up and throwing poop at people, and it's pretty close to what we do. I mean, chimpanzees kind of smile and kind of chatter, and it's almost a giggle. So I'm not convinced that humor is the dividing line. It seems like they do play tricks on each other.
Do you think there is a dividing line at all? I mean, is there some threshold at which, you know, a qualitatively different behavior or understanding,
you know,
becomes possible?
It's tough for me because I think my knee-jerk reaction is no. I think that humans are somehow frightened of simply being placed on that same continuum, that we haven't quite gotten over the insult that Darwin provided, that we're really just one of the gang of evolved creatures that has managed to survive and that we do pretty well out here, but so does everything else that has survived. So I think that we do like to be different and special. At the same time, I do have to take seriously that, you know, I watch Stephen Colbert, the cats do not care. I work on my laptop much of the day. The cats occasionally walk on the laptop, but they don't seem to have any understanding of why I might be upset that they're adding editorial notes to my email and so on. So we seem to be more language-oriented, or at least language in the way that we understand it. Maybe we just don't understand their communicative systems very well. We seem to be very caught up in our heads. And for this notion, I have to credit Temple Grandin, right? She says that human beings live in this sort of abstract world where we're way up in the general, in our expectations, in our thoughts about the future, to the point where we don't even see things right in front of us if we don't expect them to be there. We're busy generating ideas. And it does seem like many animals, at least, are more aware of the world around them because they're less caught up in their expectations or perhaps their neuroses. Human beings can be very neurotic. But even that, now that I've said that, I've seen neurotic animals. I think that they do have sophisticated communicative systems and that maybe we're just not catching on to how similar we are to them.
What do you think is the relationship, if any, between language and music? And while on that topic, maybe are there musical animals? Of course, birds sing, et cetera, but is there a sense of music the way we might understand it and variations?
So interestingly, that's the other dividing line that Merlin Donald proposes, is that humans get music and rhythm and melody and harmony and all of these sophisticated things, and animals don't. And one of the unfortunate things for his book is that he uses as an example that birds can't dance. And so, of course, if you've been on YouTube any time in the past 5 years or so, you've seen all of these cockatiels dancing to Elvis and to, you know, Suge Knight and so on. They seem to really like rap and rhythm and blues, and they do very well with rhythm and meter, and they change up the groove when the harmonies come in. And so, animals do seem to understand music. Give me the rest of the question though, because I feel like I dropped half of it in
the Well, so the relationship between language and music
yeah.
Did one precede the other possibly? And then with respect to animals, whether they're musical,
you know,
as well as using language, or are the species that seem to be more advanced in language also more likely to have something resembling music that I guess they might even make themselves? So vocalization is when they know that no other animal can hear them.
There's so many directions to take that question. So one thing that I want to get in really quickly is that coyotes are cacophonic. They do not blend. They do not harmonize. It's not melodic. It's
even
clashing.
To their own ears, maybe.
Well, and right, and how can we know? In a sense, we can't really know, but we do know that they hear much better than we do. So at least twice as well as we do. Cats hear 4 times as well as we do. So think about that and what how the world must sound to them. But wolves harmonize when they chorus howl. And it's almost striking, the musical qualities that you see there. And they are traditional Western octaves. How boring and how fascinating is that? So yeah. You'll get one wolf come in with a certain note, and the next wolf will come in exactly one octave higher. You'll get the third wolf coming in exactly one octave lower. So you're getting this streamlined chorus howl, and that's, I think, maybe what picks up human ears, is that there's something recognizable and musical in the Western sense about a wolf chorus howl. Back to your question regarding music and language, it seems like music is sophisticated in certain ways that are similar to language. And it seems like music conveys all this meaning, right? We love music, and oh, it's my favorite song, and we get very excited, right? So it seems like they would be very, very similar. But all of the mathematicians I know, when they're actually parsing out what language looks like mathematically in terms of randomness versus repetition and order, they're very, very different. Musical scores do not map on to linguistic patterns at all. So if you graph them out, it's almost like language goes one way and music goes a different way. So maybe we need to reconceive of what language is, or what deeper communication is, because clearly music is important and sophisticated and complex, and it communicates something, but it doesn't mathematically map onto language at all. So it seems to be a different kind of thing. Now, of course, books have been written that disagree with that, that say that music has everything to do with language, but mathematically speaking, it doesn't look that way.
Interesting. One other aspect of this whole question about language and meaning that you've been involved with is whether it's possible, or how would we determine that some communication we might pick up from elsewhere in the universe might represent an intelligent signal with some mind behind it and conveying some kind of meaning. And I'm not sure what the status of that is, but could you tell us a little bit about that?
Wow, okay, yeah. So yeah, I teach philosophy of astrobiology as well as other animals. And I'm so glad that I get to teach both, because I think that ultimately they're almost the same subject, because it's all about getting into the mind of something that is different from you and trying to communicate with it, exchange symbols, exchange information. What I can tell you about SETI is that, so everybody knows about the wow signal from the 70s, right? That there was this encoded message that had just the right amount of randomness and just the right amount of order, such that it did not come from a pulsar, and it did not come from any sort of natural event. And I had the honor and privilege of reading the report 25 years after that signal was heard at Arecibo. And we still don't know where it came from. But what we have done is rule out that it came from Earth. We know that it's not an old transmission of I Love Lucy. We know it's not a military exercise. We know that it came from somewhere out there, and that it was ordered, and that it looked like it had some sort of meaning encoded in it. And then there was silence for years and years and years. And then we got another signal in May of 2014. And then we got another signal in 2015 and in 2016. Now, some of this is because our ability to detect has gotten better, right? We have more radio telescopes. We are better at decoding. We are faster at going through the data that we receive. So I don't mean to necessarily suggest that they tried us in the 70s and now they're trying us again in the new millennium. But we are suddenly getting signals that do not seem to be from Earth to the best of our ability to measure that. That look like they're coming from somewhere else and look like they are code and that they mean something. Now that I've gotten everyone excited, let's back up. We can't even tell if birds have a language or not, because birdsong has both so much randomness and so much orderliness in it that it could be linguistic. Or it could just be a bunch of noises that they're making, like clattering in a kitchen. Mm-hmm. So humans are very bad at signal detection with all of our sophisticated mathematics, with all of our linguistics, with all of our philosophy. We still don't have a theory of meaning that really works, that helps us know if whales are really singing sonnets to each other, or just saying, hey baby, hey baby, hey baby. So we don't know.
Well, at the same time, humans are very good at interpreting or seeing things where there might be randomness, images in a pizza or in stains on a wall and such. So how about that aspect of it? Is it possible that we're just imagining that there's some communication there?
Man, that's such a great question. And that's so, great cutting edge neuroscience. That's Michael Gazzaniga came up with this whole notion of the left brain as not just an interpreter, but as a meaning generator. So we're going to see faces when there aren't any, and we are going to find meanings and patterns where there aren't any because it was evolutionarily conducive for us to do so. In fact, it's evolutionarily conducive for pretty much everything with a big enough brain to look for patterns, to look for cause and effect relationships and so on. So absolutely, it's so easy for us to overinterpret and add meaning to things that it means that we need to add yet another level of mathematical and philosophical rigor before we can say, yes, I do talk to my cat and my cat talks back, or yes, I do speak wolf and I know what they're saying. I think that it's exciting for us to think about these things. And I also think that, hunters, coyote calls, hunting devices, you'll pick it up at the store and it's $7.95 and you flip it over, this coyote call, and it says, oh yeah, if you do this, you'll sound like a female in heat. And if you do this, you'll sound like a wounded rabbit. And if you do, right, da da da. It's like, there's no science behind this. This is just sort of like folk wisdom and observations of what works to get the coyotes to come. So we're running with our best guess with all of that left brain interpretation on and working. And I think we need to be more careful than we are.
Well, speaking of interpretation from sparse signals, in some ways we're changing how we communicate. We're texting,
right.
Few words often misinterpreted and so on. Do you think the nature of human language will be changing as we start using these other technologies in new ways?
Humans have always had several tiers of language going on, right? This is why the French have their board of folk who keep the language standardized at all costs, whereas other languages change and morph with the times. Language is a very organic thing. So yeah, now we have texting. I can't resist adding to this that the last time we responded to the wow signal, we projected something back, and it was all text messages that people had submitted. So how interesting that what we think now in the 21st century is that extraterrestrial culture that might be out there, that might have sent us a message, they want us to text them. So I get a huge kick out of that. But yeah, texting is interesting because it relies on a notion of the culture and all sorts of background assumptions, or we're not going to get it. And we've had lots of cultural discussions about how we don't get it without emojis and proper use of emojis. And, you know, if I say the eggplant emoji, everyone laughs and I don't have to explain it because we know that it's an allusion to something. So there's all this code, layered on code that lets us understand text. In medieval times, we didn't have a lot of people who were literate in Europe. So if you were a shoemaker, you had a sign that was just a picture of a shoe outside your door, right? And if you were a tailor, you just had a picture of a dress or a suit outside your door so that people would know what that meant. So it seems like we've always used abbreviational signals to try to help everybody understand what's going on. And texting is just like the latest form of having a picture outside your door saying, hey, this is the South Knife Bistro. This is a place to eat. Here's a plate of food.
Mm-hmm. I met Sarah again 2 weeks later to learn more specifically about the studies of coyotes, wolves, dogs, and cats, and also about what's involved in actually carrying out the work. I asked how she justified funding for her projects and what drove her personally to forge ahead.
One of the things that we've noticed in the park also is that the wolves and the coyotes seem to communicate with each other. We know that the coyotes sound very, very like wolves, which is really, really interesting. They don't do that in other parts of the country. But aside from the initial yip, right, that coyotes are a very classic coyote to start everything with a yip and then they go off and chatter and howl. Aside from that, they imitate the long tonal patterns of the wolves. And we don't know if that's because they're trying to disguise themselves as wolves or perhaps they're just trying to kind of fit in and get along. There are lots of questions about the relationships between coyotes and wolves across the country. On the East Coast, they interbreed. And on the West Coast, they don't. So you end up with bigger coyotes and often smaller wolves on the East Coast, whereas you have a pretty big divergence in size as soon as you get into the western area, Montana, California. Mm-hmm. So their communication patterns are very different, and it does seem like they're talking with one another, but we don't know what they're saying.
How about coyotes or wolves with domestic dogs? Do you think they understand each other at all? Does a dog hearing a coyote just know there's something out there or have some sense maybe? Do you suspect?
So I can only go on, I don't have any science on that, but I have some personal experiences where I was living in California and we had a dog and the coyotes came and actually they're very, very clever as we know and they grouped off into two groups and sort of created this pincer movement around the dog and the dog was barking and kind of panicking and seemed to be going back and forth between wanting to defend the lawn, but also really wanting to run away because clearly they were coming in numbers and there was a threat and the coyotes were doing their usual little kind of cacophonic yips where it sounds like there are, you know, 400 of them when there are really only four.
Do you think the coyotes or wolves also use their vocalizations against the prey? I mean, do they try to frighten prey, do you think?
Well, there's something called the Bogest effect, and that's the effect that I mentioned where you can have four coyotes and it sounds like there are 25 because it seems like there's something purposeful going on and where they do not match tone and where they yip offbeat, and so it sounds like there are many, many, many. That could be to frighten prey or to press prey into a certain direction. Or it could be to protect themselves from larger predators like wolves, to sound like they are legion, and so the wolves had better not come by.
So I know you've worked not only on dog species, but also cats, and both feral and domestic cats. Can you tell us a little bit about differences you have observed there and whether there's any communication there?
Well, that is the question. So I'm working on a paper right now based on a project in 2014 and 2015 where I had a total of 30 feral cats in my basement over the course of 2 years. So I really get to be the cat lady, I think. So these feral cats make all sorts of sounds, and there are lots of papers out there showing that feral cats seem to have a much larger vocal repertoire, whereas domestic cats tend to just kind of say meow and purr, and that's about it. So one of the questions is, why is there such a difference, and is there more sophisticated communication going on in feral cat colonies? It would certainly make sense. We tend to think of cats as solitary predators, but they're not. If you let them out in the wild and they go wild or go feral, they group up and they find abandoned homes or little places where they can colonize, where there's a food source. They cooperate in terms of taking care of their young. They cooperate in terms of guarding nest areas. So definitely you've got a lot of female cooperation. And of course there are the tales of teaching their kittens to hunt by bringing partially injured prey back and letting the kittens learn how to hunt that. So it seems like cats are very social, that they do learn from one another and that they do cooperate. And then you have this great variety of sounds that they make when they're wild. So what we're trying to do is capture those initial sounds when they're wild, and then how do those sounds change as they become more and more accustomed to people, as they become more socialized and more domestic. And it seems like there is a change. We have at least 26 calls of feral cats right now, so 26 different words or phrases. We don't know quite if they are referring to something or if they are communicating situations to each other. There are certainly cases where we have the mother calling to the kittens and the kittens calling to the mother, so kind of location and taking care calls. And there are other calls as well that you just don't see in domestic cats. So we're still sorting through the data, and we have hundreds of hours of data to sort through. But it's really looking like when cats communicate with each other, they say different things in different ways. And when cats communicate with humans, the vocabulary seems to be more limited.
Mm. Maybe because we're so poor at understanding what they're
right.
trying to tell us.
What can the cat say
to
a human, but hey, stupid.
Baby talk.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the actual process of carrying out this work, starting from recordings in the field? And maybe you can describe a particular occasion on which you've done that. What sort of notes do you need to take? What sort of equipment do you take out with you? And then how much analysis do you do yourself, or how much do you pass on to collaborators that work with you?
So we go to Yellowstone. When we're up and running in a field season, we go to Yellowstone about twice a week. We have 5 wildlife acoustics SM3 units. I know that sounds very fancy, but really they're just weatherproof recording devices with great microphones and great memory capacity. So we bring them out. They can take the cold. They can take the rain. We make contact with Rick McIntyre, and he's absolutely wonderful for working with us 3 years in a row. And we ask him where the wolves are and what they're up to that day. And so he'll say, oh, there's a kill over in Lamar Valley, or we've been hearing a lot of activity down in Wapiti, or something like that. So he's wonderful in helping us locate good, safe places to put the equipment. And then the challenges are, we need to place the equipment close to the wolves, also in sort of a circle or a triangle, so that we can capture those howls when the wolves get in the middle of an array. That's exactly what we want, so we can track their motion. But we also need to take care not to leave them out somewhere where someone hiking in the park is going to find them, because you'll get anything from just a curious tourist poking the buttons and changing all of our settings to maybe somebody who actually knows that that's a really expensive, wonderful recording device and might make off with it. So we encounter all these challenges. We hike anywhere from 1 mile to 8 miles, kind of depending on where the wolves are, place our units, and then we'll go back down in 2 or 3 days, change out the batteries, change out the memory cards, and upload the data when we get back. there's usually pizza and beer involved somewhere along the way too. So I work with fantastic students, Emma Narotsky, Jackson Engel, Savannah Leadholt, just great, great people who are so smart and so self-sufficient and do all this problem solving in the field on their own. I usually go down twice a semester, but they're down twice a week taking care of all that data. So we come back, pizza and beer, upload some data. Uploading the data takes a while. That's a lot of patience. So we have a hard drive backup, and then we slingshot it, thanks to MSU IT. We have a wonderful little wormhole where we can upload terabytes of data in just a few minutes, and we send it over to London, where my research partner, Eric Kirschenbaum, does the mathematics, does the trigonometry, so that we can actually track how where the wolves are moving by the sounds that they're making.
Does he also help with the acoustic analysis in terms of trying to determine units that might be words or otherwise analyze the conversation that's going on, if we can call it that?
We're just starting that. We have set up this semester to get two different sources where we can get context regarding what the wolves are doing. And one of the fun things about this is one person's observations of what the wolves are doing are not necessarily another person's. So it makes you very aware of the human element, right? Someone will say, oh, that wolf is guarding the pack. And another will say, oh no, that wolf is perfectly relaxed and is just kind of watching the world go by. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of lift off these different interpretations, just get to the behaviors themselves, and then start matching with types of howl. We do know that chorus howls are linked with bonding behavior, and with if we've had a successful hunt, we seem to get together in chorus howl. But there are other cases of chorus howls as well, so probably have many, many different functions for that. And then there are contact calls and lots of things that we still need to sort out.
Mm-hmm. So are the wolves under observation while you're recording, or do you also leave recorders out in the field and, you know, for days on end perhaps?
All of the above. So that's why we go down twice a week, because sometimes the wolves are very convenient and they just stay in the same place. And so we just swap out the batteries and, you know, watch the wolves for a while and then take off for the day. But sometimes they range pretty widely. And if they're ranging, then we have to pick up all the units, bring them back to the car, add the batteries, do everything, check them out, and then we hike out to the new location and replace them. So we really are making an effort to follow them as closely as we can.
Mm-hmm. So in the course of this work, how do you decide when to publish a paper, say, or give a talk on some unit of knowledge that you've learned? You know, particular questions that you've been able to settle, maybe small questions within the field?
I think our most exciting paper is the Disentangling Howls Across Species paper. And that was because we have the international consortium of all these different people who are studying cooperative predators around the world. We had people who recorded jackals and foxes and singing dogs and different kinds of wolves, red wolves and gray wolves and coyotes from different parts of the country and so on. And we just put them all in a database. And again, Eric, our great mathematician at Cambridge, came up with an algorithm so that we could sort out and identify species. And it's fantastic because the dialects are so different. It, just within a species, from East Coast to West Coast, or European wolves sound different from American wolves. So one might predict that, you know, we would never be able to identify if it's a wolf or a coyote, especially if the coyotes are imitating the wolves in Yellowstone, but we can. There are certain vocal features that let us know which species is which, even though they sound so different from place to place. So that's really exciting. But to go back and answer the initial question, how do we decide? It's kind of a combination of kismet, Maybe a conference comes up, like the Malone Conference next month at Montana State on wild animals in the Wild West. There's some conference that matches us somehow, and we go, oh, we can do wolves and coyotes here, or, oh, you know, we just got this data on chorus owls, and here's a call for papers. So a lot of it's that. A lot of it is when we get together and talk. Suddenly, you know, we'll realize that we've both been thinking the same thing, or that we've both had an inkling that we want to go in a certain direction, that we want to go in this new behavioral direction to try to map calls onto behaviors. So it kind of depends on what people are thinking at the time and what people are motivated to do, and we look at the data and see what we have.
Well, besides all the time and effort that you and students and collaborators are putting into this, this kind of work takes money. You must receive grants from various agencies or organizations. So I'm just wondering, when you're writing those proposals or talking to those agencies, how do you justify to them the costs of this kind of research in so conventional, socially acceptable terms? And are those different from your personal motivations? I mean, what drives you to...
Oh, great question. So, I mean, of course, you can't write a grant that says, I'm curious and I want to talk to the wolves and I want to talk to the coyotes and I secretly want to be Dr. Doolittle, right? That's probably not going to work. So we tend to use justifications which are extremely important, which are about wildlife management, conservation, trying to find solutions for the conflict between human beings and wolves, human beings and coyotes, right? You have conflicts with ranchers and farmers, and if we can find a peaceful solution, that's better than, you know, having all-out war. And it's very controversial, right? We've got laws that change every so often, both here and in Wyoming, all around in the wolf. The states that didn't have wolves for a while because we killed them all, and now the wolves are back, and we have a lot to manage and think about. So we tend to use that as a scientific justification, because if we can find calls or signals that will keep the wolves away from livestock, then we have a very, very useful tool that's going to help everyone. But yes, there are deeper motivations. It's so interesting to think about cooperative species getting together with brains very similar to ours, with activities very similar to ours. We also raise children, seek shelter and food, have social relationships, have shared goals like hunting. So we're very similar in a lot of ways. So maybe the way that they communicate can tell us a lot about how human minds work and how language evolved for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating work, and I look forward to hearing more about it over the coming years as you progress with that research.
Well, thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your inquiry with us.
Great to be here.